Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Augustin Macellari.
Today's the last day of London's annual art extravaganza, Frieze. Rob and I went down so you didn't have to. We'll be discussing what we learned.
We'll also be meeting Hetty Judah, art writer and critic, to learn more about her new book, Art London.
And we'll be hearing from painter and critic William Fever, whose epic new biography of Lucian Freud gazes in granular detail at the first decades of the artist's life.
That's all coming up, plus, as usual, some music right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. That was the art week that was in London, Org. Did you feel run ragged by the process, or are you kind of still fresh as a daisy?
I'm fresh as a daisy. I never get invited to any of the art parties.
So I started the week by cutting my hand quite badly on a broken bottle from the previous weekend's excesses, which meant that I spent most of the early part of the week in Lewisham A&E.
Mm.
Wonderful NHS. I'd like to shout out to Daniel there, who treated me wonderfully. But it meant that basically I've been off the sauce all week. I've been on antibiotics.
Oh, a shame.
And actually, I've had to have a tetanus jab in my right arm, which, yes, is my drink-holding arm. So I've been kind of paralysed for Art Week, but I have been using my eyes, as you have, Org, and seen lots of wonderful stuff at Frieze, Frieze Masters, and across the capital. And that's kind of what we're going to be talking about, aren't we? We're going to do the show in a slightly different way today. We're not going to have a news look ahead. We're going to talk about some of the things we've seen. We've got some clips of audio that we played from meeting artists and curators and various people at the art fairs and around the city. So we should start queuing them up, right? What does Frieze say, other than it's an event right up the road from us? It's an event that really does light the heart of London's art map. Later on, we'll be hearing from a pair of writers who are themselves linchpins of the scene, as discussed in the introduction. But first, let's unpack what we saw. I'm here, you find Augustin and I, at the beginning of Frieze London 2019. As usual, there's a cacophony of noise here, which you guys can obviously hear. But also, this is where, and I presume this is kind of like New York real estate, where the big boys take centre stage. We're staring right at David Zwirner. To the left of him are Sprit Muggers, and Esther Schipper is to the right. It's a little bit like merchant banks jockeying for position on Wall Street.
You feel Goldman Sachs there, Lehman Brothers just
Lehman
next door.
The famous Lehman Brothers. Should we try and get jobs there, or what could possibly go wrong?
It's meant to be a really great employer.
It's a very good employer.
So what's the first thing you see when you come in is actually this quite lovely Kerry James Marshall. It's a good one. A lady leaning on a car, looking at a dog leaning out the window of the car, looking back at the lady.
I expect there's some metaphor there that I'm not understanding. I'm glad you're picking up on it. But Kerry James Marshall, I know you interviewed him for this very radio station. You did a great big interview with Kerry, and yeah, it's a sort of amazing thing. It's a nice kind of statement of intent for the fair, which is juggling all sorts of things this year. There's a woven section which is about colonial and post-colonial art, all the rest of it. We don't necessarily have to lump Kerry James Marshall in with that, but nice to see an African-American artist kind of like bold front and center. We're going to walk around, aren't we, for the rest, the sort of duration of this, and bump into some interesting people. Maybe they're buying, maybe they've bought, maybe they're artists, and try and get a flavor of this side of the fair. Starting off there, as you mentioned, big hitters, Kerry James Marshall, front and centre.
Lovely to see.
We got a little bit of inside track, didn't we, on Kerry James Marshall? I think that work sold for $3.5 million.
Something in the order of that.
To a major American museum. I don't know whether that's one of his major pieces, but certainly considering some of the stuff that's on, that's for sale at Frieze Masters, which is sort of 2,000 years old, some sort of statues that date back to the Hainan Dynasty, $1.5 million, working in dollars.
Well, it just
like
goes to
big
show
player.
That, you know, value and age are not necessarily interlinked. You could just get a stone is probably about a million years old, isn't it?
It is.
You pick up.
Yeah, exactly. Far bit for me to say, but we did say we were walking around, Frieze Masters is the art that stood the test of time. Frieze London is the art that hasn't yet.
Prove itself.
Kerry James Marshall, great. And you did a wonderful big interview with him, which I loved listening to. And I've interviewed before. He's a great man. He's a great living artist.
I think he
is. We hope that posterity treats him as well as the Hainan Dynasty.
I will interject just to say that I think if I had 3.5 million green ones lurking around in a shoebox under my bed, I could think of worse ways to spend it. Than a Kerry James.
Okay.
So there were good sales, as you said. We got that tip. We also went round this new section, the woven section. You mentioned it just there in that clip. It's new this year. It focuses on textile. And while we were there, we bumped into Monocle's Chiara Rimella, the culture editor.
Who'd have believed it?
Who'd have thunk it? At
Freeze. It's almost like we planned it as part of this programme. But you'd be surprised, listeners, that we didn't.
No way. Serendipity uber alles. That's our watchword. We bumped into her just in time to record a chat between herself and the woven section curator, the wonderfully named Cosmin Costinas. Let's have a listen to that.
Cosmin, thank you so much for making time. So, first of all, where does the idea for woven start? When did you start weaving this whole project? Pardon the horrendous pun.
Well, the initial invitation was, in fact, to do something, and also my intention was to do something that is very much related to the current moment, to the current mess of the UK, and also like to the different implications of this discussion, including the unresolved discussion about colonial legacy. So why weaving? Because on one hand, weaving textiles, fibers have always been a crucial part of art history and have always been, you know, at the core of what artistic practice meant, both here and everywhere else in the world. But it's also a legacy that has been marginalized for several reasons. And one was because it was very often associated with a practice done by women, which left it outside of the sort of main art historical narrative, but also because it was for a long time associated with practices happening outside of the West. So yet another reason for it to be marginalized. So I think with the current, you know, shifting situation in the world, it's also important to decolonize the way we relate to art and to art history. So it was important to look at this sort of core legacy of like one of the core legacies and sets of references and genealogies that exist in artistic practice. So what we did was not to make textile art show, and if we would have done that, we would have only reinforced that separation and the sort of process of creating a ghetto for, you know, textile art as something separate from mainstream art. So what we did was to basically show eight amazing artists who each deal with this legacy and with this language and with these materials that are there in very different ways.
Where do we draw the line between weaving as craft and weaving as art? How do we realize when a woven piece becomes art?
The difficulty of making this definition is equivalent to, you know, deciding when decoration made in any other language or medium stops being decoration and becomes art. So it's the same with, you know, design versus, or, you know, object making for the purpose of decoration and art. So I think the process of defining what becomes art is similar, and it's based not so much on formal qualities but the intent of the artist and the sort of like value that that object has in a system that is both aesthetic and social.
So that was an interesting chat there with Cosmin Costinas, curator of the woven section at Frieze. What are your thoughts, Rob, on that closing question there, that given this is an art fair, what do you think of honing in on a particular medium like this, textiles, arguably a craft? How do you rate that? I mean, is it not the same as having a pottery section? I know it has these kind
that's
of post-colonial ramifications.
Yeah. I know it's got all those ramifications. I think that's a separate thing. But in terms of the trend of the artefact, whether it's, you know, it's people working in oil on canvas or it's people working in plaster and it's whatever it is. I mean, we saw this when we were there this week, that Frieze is so much, it always says that it's a meeting point. Yes, it's a sale room in lots of ways, but it's such a meeting point. You really see that. And I think as you get older, you kind of appreciate that kind of, you see so many people from so many different kind of walks of life that are sort of dip one toe in the art world, but it's a place where everyone kind of meets and does business and kind of hooks up different things, whether they're curatorial or simply business. So having actual curated sections, it used to be slightly scoffed at, but I think they get stronger and stronger with every year, actually. So I was really impressed with that section. I liked it. Woven.
Not far from there, to the part of the fair given over to smaller emerging galleries, we were both struck there by the Stockwell-based gallery, the Sunday Painters Stall.
Yeah.
Ceramic sculptures, amazing. Titans by Nicholas Pope.
We sort of laughed at them to begin with. We kind of were like, look at that. That's amazing. What are they doing here? These huge things like stalagmites.
Yeah.
How high are they?
Four meters. 4.5 meters high.
Oh, you've got a good memory.
I do remember. Well, I've just listened to the chat.
Okay.
Let's have a listen to it.
Nicholas, thank you very much for joining us today. Yahweh and the Seraphim are what we're looking at. Congratulations on these stunning works, stalagmites of things. Tell us about the title, maybe, first of all.
Celestial columns rather than stalactites. Yahweh is down on earth. This large black thing,
yeah,
the inscribed letters round it say, I am Yahweh. And then these are the celestial columns, and the seraphims are flying round in heaven up above. And they've got six wings, because they're very shy. So they cover their faces with two wings and their bottoms with two wings, and then they fly with the other ones.
This is a beautifully realised... I didn't realise it was such a polite work of art, Nicholas, because to us it looked a little bit... They're very erect. It looks a little bit like the opposite of an artwork that was hiding its light under a bushel, but clearly not.
I think there are multiple ways to think of it.
Yeah.
It can be an aggressive, rude, anti belief object, or it can be the other way around. It just depends how you want to take it.
How were you thinking about it when you were making it?
I tend to make in a vacuum, so I tend just to be nowhere at all.
Because this looks like a work, I guess it's a work of adoration, right? It's a work of, it looks like there's something ritualistic and sort of, it looks like almost like an annunciation.
Well, it is in fact a reredos, which you'll know is the object of veneration behind an altar. And so it's a reredos for my hypothetical chapel, the Chapel of Heavenly Space, which is referred to in the books. And there's a booklet about the Chapel of Heaven, or the Oratory of Heavenly Space, which I've designed and made other things for, like the Ten Commandment pots, and the Ten Commandment pots, King James Version, and some fonts.
We don't hear much about faith in art anymore, and it was the driving force behind some of the greatest art that's ever sort of existed. Do you think that that's a shortfall on the part of makers in the contemporary world?
Well, I'm glad you referred to it as faith, but I like to call it belief. And I think there is a shortfall. I started making things about belief 25, 30 years ago, and now we are belief or faith is absolutely central to the world's thinking. And I'm pleased that I'm making work about that subject that gives everybody sometimes strength, sometimes problems, sometimes war.
And outside of the chapel, these works, I mean, they're huge. We should tell our listeners that they are 12 foot high, 15 foot high.
3 meters.
Sorry, I went all imperial there.
Yeah, you did. You caught me out. I thought everybody younger than me was in centimetres.
There's a guy that's going to know his metres. But they're huge, commanding works. I mean, together and presumably singularly as well. Where do they sit in the chapel? And what does the rest of that look like?
Well, the reredos is at the behind the altar.
Oh, right, of course. Sorry.
The chapel has many fingers, which are little lady chapels where you can go down and pray individually. And then there's a floor of the chapel, and you come up in escalators through the floor from down below. And there's a drawing in one of my books with the chapel in it. And then it's in a landscape, and around in the drawing are flying believers and non-believers, and the believers are falling to earth, and they're flight costumes have collapsed, but the believers are soaring away through like the seraphim.
Have you developed any of the rituals that will be performed in the chapel of belief?
No, the only thing that I'm insistent on or believe is that the floor will be muddy or suctiony, maybe very upholstered, so as you walk across it, you'll be like stuck in mud. So again, that can be you can take that as a view of mine about belief, that it's bloody hard work.
Well, that was Nicholas Pope. He's a fantastic chap. I go and genuflect in his chapel.
I thought
that was wonderful. I loved him talking about his work. Such unusual stuff. Kind of nice to see an artist working out of Herefordshire, bringing his stuff to market in London, and such interesting, amazing stuff. We should say to our listeners that Nicholas was maybe an artist in his 60s. He's not the wellest man. He's got Parkinson's disease. And he's obviously a tall man, slightly stooped, but what a charming person to spend time with and talk to, and what a glint he had in his eye about work that obviously, I think he made those works in 1995, and they obviously, if it works out, will become part of a huger, larger project.
Yeah, this amazing...
I don't know if he'll realise the whole chapel,
dream.
But
Rothko's chapel, eat your heart out.
Yeah.
Interesting about Nicholas, I went away and read about him because I was so, well, I was so taken by these things. He represented England at the Venice Biennale in 1980.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did he?
Yeah, yeah.
That's and amazing. That's, you feel that it might have been a slightly more pure time and commercial galleries didn't quite strong-arm people into the process like they do now.
Well, quite. I mean, look, there are many stalls at Frieze, these commercial galleries, trying to strong-arm people, but others clamouring for attention in a different way. There's always something that's quite novel. A participatory, experiential-based, durational artwork, if you like.
Are you talking about... the drinking competition.
We're not going to mention that. I'm in fact talking about the impromptu medical gallery at Ike Gallery, a Chinese one. A friendly quack doctor there was patching people up with plaster of Paris, wasn't he?
This is like too attractive a proposition to turn down. Well, it's nice, isn't it? It's sort of a weird, beguiling thing. One of my hands is already up the creek in a bandage, and so. I asked them if they wanted to do my right hand. No, they wanted to do my left hand. Trying to get home that night on the tube and get into my house and cook dinner. That was pretty difficult.
Don't worry about Rob, folks.
Bound as I was.
He's armless.
Hey!
Let's have a listen.
Let's just cut to this.
Yeah, I'm sat in a little plastic chair. It's nice to sit down. One of the only installations you can sit down at Frieze. It's very welcome. And we're
which
surrounded...
One?
Huh?
Which part?
Finger?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, maybe this one. Oh.
So we've got a doctor here who's got some plaster, he's got some mod rock, and he's just making a little splint for Rob. Rob's got a hurty thumb. He slashed it. So he's going to have his finger done.
On a different one, I think, because I think that's actually under medical supervision. What have people been having done here? What parts of the body have people been having wrapped?
The neck part and the eye.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's really cool. I can show you the picture.
Did anyone do their ear or anything?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Only six parts that you can choose where you want to wrap.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So we've got you can have both eyes. You can have a neck brace. You can have a little finger, which I'm having.
It's kind of like a joke, you know. Everybody had a fake injured in the fair. So you just like force people to take a rest and to think about how work life should balance or how our life is fragile.
And you've got some badges here which say that rest is the best kind of revolution.
Yeah, it's the whole artwork's name. So as you can see, our booth is set up like a replica of a 60s and 70s Chinese hospital-like. Yeah, and artist himself, Tang Dixing, pretend to be a fake doctor to force people to take a rest. He was injured back in 2009. And at that time, he was preparing his solo exhibition, but because of his breaking arm, so he barely cannot do anything. So he, during that period, he's kind of think about how rest is important for the people. And that old Chinese saying is that if you want to do big deal, you have to take good rest first.
Are people having this signed by people as they walk around? So you have that tradition. We had it at school, where when you have a broken arm or something, you have the hard plaster, and then people would sign it or write kind of friendly or rude things on it. Did you have that?
Yeah, we have that in China as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Do you ever have that, Rob?
I never broke anything, only fingers and thumbs.
I had an ankle with some quite naughty drawings on it.
Really? What were they of? Are they sort of... Don't forget this goes out at noon on Sunday.
Male genitals. How did you find that experience of binding bound?
I felt kind of restricted, but not unpleasurably.
Well, sometimes it's nice to be tied up, isn't it? Of course. Frieze doesn't just take place in that very large tent. There's also the sculpture park, which is scattered around the English Garden of Regent's Park. I got a tour earlier this summer from the curator Claire Lilly. We first broadcast it on episode 522 of the Monocle Weekly. But let's listen to a bit now.
Well, I'm a kind of devotee, a sculptor in the open air. That's what I do up in Yorkshire and in other places. And for me, it's just the best way to see sculpture. It means that people can go up to it. Quite often they can touch it, not always, but sometimes, in some cases in this show, people can walk over some of the sculpture or go inside it. So that physical contact is incredibly important because we share the same space as sculpture. It's unlike other art forms in that respect. And I suppose I'm really thinking about how people use this space, and I'm very aware of all the paths that come in here. I'm aware of all the different types of people who come here, you know, mums with their babies and groups of children, as we've just seen. And they will come in here and they'll be drawing and they'll be, you know, they'll be using the sculpture. At the same time, I'm working for an art fair, and they have customers, they have clients. So what I try to do in bringing this group of works together is something that works for everybody. So getting really important artists into this one space. I'm very, very keen to get as diverse a range of artists as I can from around the world, as many women as I can, which I think is very important. And also to have works which, you know, just by their nature, again, appeal to people who haven't ever really looked at contemporary art before. And I suppose I really hope that this might open something up for people and for them to kind of venture into a museum or a gallery in a way that they may not have done ever in their lives before.
I think you mentioned getting more women into it, and that's really interesting because when people think of sort of outdoor public sculpture, maybe their minds immediately leap for kind of hyper-masculine, like huge Richard Serra sculptures or kind of interventions on the landscape. And that, you know, maybe that's a bit of an outdated sense of what outdoor sculpture is.
It's not exactly outdated. I think we're seeing shifts. I mean, we've been seeing shifts in this for a good 40 years, but it takes time. And, you know, to make outdoor sculpture is really expensive. It's expensive materially. It's also difficult to do in terms of having a structure around you that allows you to do that. And I often sort of cite the case of Joan Miró, who was one of the world's leading artists as a painter. It wasn't until he was in his 50s that he began to make sculpture. It wasn't until he was in his 50s he had the money to do it. He had the studio, the contacts, the whole structure that allows you to do that. So when I see young artists making work which is physically able to withstand the outdoors, I'm just, you know, I'm absolutely delighted. And you know, we have a cyclical problem, which is that galleries will invest in their artists who have a market value. Those who have a market value tend to be men. They therefore don't invest in their women. And so you can, you know, you can see this perpetuating thing. Far more art galleries are investing in their younger artists, their emerging artists, and in women. And you see that here. So you see somebody like Jodie Carey, who's a very young artist. She's already made a body of bronze sculptures. That's the most, one of the most expensive materials that you can use. You know, it's the sculptor's material. And that's because there are people around her who are supporting her in that endeavour.
What do you think of that?
I thought that was wonderful. Claire Lilly's excellent, isn't she? Proper grown-up, excellent curator.
Really good.
Nice chat.
We should do a trip up, actually, to Yorkshire Sculpture Park soon.
Yeah.
I think.
That is the latest from Midori House and Frieze Week. Kind of, but it's an art-themed programme today. In a moment, we'll be back with more art in London as we meet the writer Hetty Judah, author of Art London.
We've heard all about the busiest art week of the year in England's capital. But what happens, Rob, over the other 51?
No one knows.
While London has never had the collecting tradition of the Big Apple or the historical resonance of Medici-funded Florence, it's occupied a unique position in the visual arts for, well, a long time.
A new book by journalist, curator, editor and art writer Hetty Judah untangles the knots of London's rich but sometimes overlooked artistic history in her new handily geographically delineated survey of visual culture in the city. And I caught up with Hetty earlier this week to find out more. Hetty, thank you so much for joining us on what is the busiest week in London for art. You've written a book called Art London. I'm sensing that your publishers have got a keen weather eye on publication date.
One would think so, but actually it's entirely coincidental.
Is it really?
They approached me just over a year ago with the idea of doing this book, and they gave me total carte blanche as to what to put inside it. So I could have done anything Art London. I could have done a book of London monuments. As it was, I chose to do a book that was looking at the art history of London and also places you could see art. So it works quite well for Frieze Week.
Yeah, it's not bad. I feel like this will be reviewed, we hope, as the definitive guide to art in the capital. It is tote bag sized, if not pocket sized. I mean, I'm expecting at next year's Frieze at least to see this well thumbed, crammed with post-it notes, and people arguing the toss about which part of London is the best for art. I mean, people are pretty sort of geographically precise. It's a bit like supporting a football team. Was it easy? Did you kind of find the mother load of kind of great art in one part of London and not in another? Talk us through the process.
I mean, it's funny because it shifts around really quite rapidly at the moment. And you'll suddenly find that as soon as one postcode gets quite, you know, warm, then suddenly the developers move in and the studios get shut down and, you know, everybody has to move out somewhere else. And so there's this constant chase, and there has been for decades, possibly even centuries, you know, from one neighbourhood to the other. I mean, I guess in the mid-18th century, it was all in Covent Garden because that was where you had these rundown alleyways. And, you know, you get these reports of artists' studios in the mid-18th century, and they had these hazardous floorboards. And, you know, it's much worse than you'd get anywhere in London now. And indeed, in the 1970s, when you had people using the kind of, you know, the docklands, and they had no heating and no running water, and they, you know, full of rats, and it was kind of disgusting. But you had all of this space you could use. And, you know, it continues to be the same thing. So at the moment, Deptford feels like it's reheating.
Yeah.
You know, there are some really exciting spaces opening in Deptford. But people do also get quite, as you say, quite tribal about their areas of London. Part of my tragedy is that I live in an area of London that doesn't have very many art spaces in it.
So you've kind of maxed out the travel card then to research the book.
Yeah, I really
did. Sadly, not that much in walking distance. So tell us how you chose the artist. You've got Damien Hirst in there, perhaps, inevitably. You've got Mike Nelson, a very interesting contemporary artist. How did you choose, because you're going to kill a lot of darlings by doing that, how did you choose the artist to fit the areas?
Well, I mean, it wasn't just a beauty contest in terms of talent. It was very much artists that I felt, you know, had a really important role in the history of London and the history of art in London. So in some cases, those were people like Rashid Araïn, who has been this presence, really important presence for about 50 years on the London art scene. And he perhaps isn't a household name in the way that Damien Hirst is, but he's founded very important journals of art criticism. He was part of the first wave of artists working in the space studios that Bridget Riley founded. He's curated two really important exhibitions of art that were focusing on the diaspora artists living in London. So he was painting a much broader picture of what London art looked like than that kind of simple white male European
and kind of real London and the sort of stratified elements of it rather than the people that maybe buy and sell art.
Yeah. So I wanted to create a really broad picture of it. And actually, one of the most important things that I wanted to show with this book is that almost the defining feature of London art as opposed to British art is the fact that it's incredibly cosmopolitan. And it has been for centuries. I mean, really going back five centuries, we've been quite reliant on our talent coming into London from overseas.
And you start, and I love your style of writing where you pack in so much. Your introduction sweeps us through some of the centuries of art in London, and we quite soon end up in Cork Street, which at the turn of the 20th century, I suppose, 19th and 20th centuries, was one of the epicentres of it. And I was reading that entry about Cork Street, which was such an epicentre, near to the Royal Academy and all that sort of thing, and thinking how quickly things change. Because in the sort of late 90s, noughties, when I started being interested in it and going to things, that sort of felt a bit bereft and dusty. So tell us about how that became, as Cork Street, for example, became something and then wasn't one and now is again, I suppose.
I mean, as you very presciently pointed out, it's right next to the Royal Academy, and the Royal Academy was the place where new art got showed. I mean, the summer exhibition, as we now call it, which just used to be referred to as the exhibition.
So good. So wonderfully imperially definitive, right?
Yeah, so that's where, you know, if you wanted to show new work, that's where you tried to show it. And you have places like the Mall Galleries that then set up as in opposition to that, and the Grosvenor Gallery on Bond Street. But there were very, very few places to show new art in London at that point. And it's kind of funny, if you look back down the centuries, you know, in the days before television and cinema, people were really starved of visual stimulation. Things like people putting a new sign up for their shop used to draw crowds because people were so excited suddenly to have this thing to look at. And so, the summer exhibition used to be packed. They used to have police protecting the most popular artworks to try and stop the crowds crushing into them. And so obviously that location was very important. So Cork Street was a very natural place for suddenly that kind of wave of commercial galleries. So it was Cork Street and Bond Street, actually. Bond Street was also really important as a site for galleries. It had some really important galleries like the Grosvenor Gallery, like the Fine Arts Society, that were modish, that were kind of setting new standards for the way that you'd show work, the kinds of art that people were excited by. There were lots of fights between artists and critics about...
Love this stuff.
You know, and I think there was even a famous court case where, you know, Ruskin got sued for a particularly spiky review. And so that area obviously was a natural rollover from the Royal Academy. And then, you know, during the First World War and the Second World War, obviously, the appetite for, or the potential for actually even spending money on art was very much diminished. So it was only in the years after the First World War when the British economy started to resettle that it started coming back up again. But I think every generation sees the one before it as being really stuffy and boring. So, I mean, if you talk to somebody like Nicholas Logsdale, who started the Listen Gallery, back when he started Listen, he was a student and he saw Cork Street as being run by these, you know, what he referred to as gentleman gym art dealers who were, you know, in their chalk striped suits with their swept back hair and their decanters of port. So you're going to want to find a new territory and to define yourself in relation to what's come before you.
Yeah, having said that, at that time also you had sort of legendary art dealers like Robert Fraser, who obviously seemed to be at the vanguard of so many revolutions that I suppose were to do with the music industry and contemporary art being looked at by different sorts of people and all the rest of it, which was done on Cork Street. You've got a little entry in Groovy Bob.
Yeah, I think he was Duke Street, right?
Oh, he was on Duke
Street. Yeah, he was
okay.
The filthy hinterland.
In the boonies.
Of St. James's, the outside.
Can you imagine the horror? What a radical. No wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was literally just a stone's throw away, all spitting distance, depending upon which yardstick you'd rather use.
But I have to say, that's been one of the really fun things about working on this book, because you realise actually how widely all of these anecdotes about the art world spread out into the wider culture. Mm. And as soon as I started writing about people like Groovy Bob, you know, I'd suddenly get people's mums going, oh, I was in his flat once and he had this lovely Andy Warhol above the table. And it would turn out they were dating a late night DJ. And so you have all of these different worlds, exactly as you say, crossing through his orbit. And the, you know, Indica Gallery as well, that was also in St. James's on Mason's Yard. So there were these bits of the subculture filtering through, but they were quite short-lived often.
The tone of the book, or rather the content and the tone of the book, you get a lot, as I said, you get a lot into it. And it's quite a sort of, it's somewhere between a reference work and a kind of love poem to London, I suppose. How did you kind of ride that seesaw between something that is something that is very useful and art aficionados and visitors to London to want to see lots of work will be able to use it, but also you can wax a little bit poetical about scenes, artists, streets, all the rest of it. It's quite a tough, journalistically, it's quite a tough sort of merry-go-round to ride that.
Well, I think journalistically is actually the key word, because I'm a journalist rather than an art historian.
Yeah.
So okay. I think if I'd been an art historian, I would have felt very married to certain narratives, and there would have been things that I felt the need to go into very deeply. But I'm a journalist, so I have, you know, a tiny colander-like brain and ideas going in and out quite fast. And so, you know, it's quite easy to do an enormous amount of research and then kind of filter out the things that you think are going to be fun. I mean, my hope with this is that people will pick it up and they'll find a story that excites them, and then they'll go off and want to learn more about it, and they'll do their own research and hopefully make an amazing feature film based on, you know, one of these little 200-word entries that I've popped in there.
And what is it about London? I know you are trying to define the different streets, neighbourhoods, areas, postcodes that go into making art in London such a kind of rich tapestry historically and in the current moment. What is Art London as opposed to Art Paris or Art New York, I wonder? What is it? Is there a honesty, wit, grit? What is it about art in London over the centuries and now that sort of is its definitive, not selling point, but the thing that sets it apart from other cities? Because a lot of people think that the contemporary art world is one big soup. And it kind of doesn't matter where you're from or where your gallery is based or where you work out of. I don't necessarily think that's true, but...
Yeah, I mean, the flippant answer to that is probably alcohol. We've been a very...
Our old buddy.
Artists in London have been really quite historically drunk. And the contemporaries of Hogarth, for example, just used to drink... I mean, even reading a list of what one person drank in one day at that point, one artist drank with, just gave me a hangover just looking at the page. It would certainly have put the YBAs to shame. And certainly the post-war generation around Francis Bacon were very heavy drinkers. Mm. I mean, I don't know whether that was connected to war trauma or, but it was, you know, quite striking. I think, obviously, looking back, we didn't have those great academies. We didn't have those great art schools that were putting out a particular style that were teaching people technique. And so right up until the foundation of the Royal Academy, which was only 250 years ago, it's relatively recent, most of our talent was coming in from overseas. And I think we didn't actually have historically a particularly mature art market. So artists weren't brilliantly supported. They didn't have great historic collectors. Certainly in the 20th century, not in the way that there were collectors in New York or Paris, I don't think. So we've had that. I mean, it's a bit like the fashion world. We've got this kind of scrappy, slightly kind of punk aspect to it. And as I was saying earlier, it's always been very cosmopolitan. I think it's been fed by all of these different viewpoints coming in from all over the world, and that's made it quite rich. It's perhaps not the most, you know, critically sophisticated.
Thank God for that.
of the art world. But I think it can be fun, and it also quite often has a sense of humour.
Thanks to Hetty Judah. Art London is unmissable and out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Time for some new music right now. Not just art in the air this week, of course. The Bacchanalian spirit runs riot across the galleries and studios of our fair city. This is Pulp, Jarvis Cocker being the frontman, of course, always a fixture at Frieze Week, DJing parties, possibly buying paintings. Here are his band Pulp performing Babies from back in 1992.
When you lived on Stanhope Road, we listened to your sister when she came home from school. Cause she was 2 years older and she had boys in her room. At least outside I heard her, alright. Well, that was alright for a while, but soon I wanted more. I wanted to see as well as hear, and so I hid inside her wardrobe, and she came home round four, and she was with some kid called David, and from the garage up the road, I listened outside, I heard her, alright.
That was The Fantastic Babies by Pulp. What do you think, Rob, today, this morning? Some sore heads the last night?
Well, yeah, normally on Saturday nights, it's the big Frieze kind of closing party. A couple of years ago, I sort of did the... I don't know if I should say this.
My friend
who used to do the comms for it let me take the microphone and close down Frieze University Commons by playing some kind of massive rave track across Frieze Masters. And everyone was like, what was that? At 8 o'clock on like the Sunday night or whatever. And then we went off merrily into the night, listening to rave and other things in exactly the right spirit to listen to it. I don't think it was what necessarily the dealers were expecting for it to be their last, the art dealers, for their last, don't make that face, for their last hurrah, but there we go.
Maybe we should have had that as our bit of music. Anyway, this is the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, a new biography of the 20th century's greatest painter.
Whew.
Stay tuned. Hyperbole, maybe. The greatest is always a problematic accolade to chuck around. But Lucian Freud surely deserves a place in at least the top five of last century's greatest. A master, his intense figurative studies have inspired generations.
Freud's painting was single-minded, which perhaps explains the chaos that engulfed the rest of his life. Notoriously private, he did confide in his friend William Fever. William kept a record of their countless hours of conversation, which forms the backbone of his new biography of the artist, the first part of which came out in September.
It's essential reading, not just for fans of Freud, but for anyone with an interest in biography, or indeed a life passionately lived, as William began by explaining to me when we sat down to talk about his tome.
I think, first of all, it's quite commonplace to say that artists, painters particularly, spend their lives indoors in their studio. Not a lot happens. They might go out on benders in the evening, but daytime, basically, it's office hours and it's working and not a lot happens. You sit down, you read a book, you fiddle around and you work and you paint. Lucian Freud was very different to all this because he fitted an awful lot into the day. And I think, if you want me to sell it, this is an action-packed tome full of names. It's scattered with names like confetti. I mean, Greta Garbo, for example, and it goes right up to Joan Collins. And it includes all sorts of people, all sorts of walks of life. And he is a kind of magnetic attraction. He's got a kind of ethos, is that the right word? Which is that the painting is the most important thing, but other aspects of life have to sort of boost it and justify his work as a painter by going out into the world and doing things like betting enormously on horses and on basically seeing that he uses every 24 hours in the day and night as one thing and one stint only.
I love that. There's a moment in this where you talk about his attitude to gambling. He either wanted to make himself rich or go home without enough money for the bus.
He did this a lot, until he became so rich that the losses became rather incidental and he was elderly by then and the bets rather died away. But yes, he loved the idea of staking everything on just one extraordinary game of skill, which, of course, horse racing appealed to him, not just because of the horses, but because of the jockeys, this bravery and this determination, this all-out to get ahead. And so gambling, painting, ordinary aspects of other aspects of daily life all cohered together very beautifully in his case.
One of the things that he seems to have been characterised by, and you can see it staring out at you from the cover of this book, he has this intensity, what seems like a kind of charisma. Was that something that you immediately recognised when you met him for the first time?
Well, I met him for the first time in the early 70s. He was going to have his first retrospective at the Hayward Gallery. He'd never had an article written about him in any publication of any length at all in his entire life when he was about to be 50. And the Sunday Times had commissioned an article from a colleague of mine who asked too many questions. Now, I was living in Newcastle, so he thought that I would be innocent out of the so I could come down from Tyneside and I could do a nice article about him. And I met him in his dealer's gallery, the Anthony Doffey Gallery, and well, I knew who he was, of course, because there they were, the piercing eyes, the shabby overcoat, the feeling that you were being not just assessed, but also sort of set up slightly. And he said that he would fix time and place and disappeared. And I went back to where I was staying for the night, and there was a knock on the door, a very loud knock on the door, and a ringing at the bell later on. And out of the night emerged this other nighttime Freud, who said exactly why we'd meet the next day, which we did, and then he disappeared. So I think I was being set up to being encountering a mystery, and I have to say it for myself that I withstood this, and we became friendly, increasingly friendly over the years, and part of a sort of little circle which he had of people that he relied on for opinions and for amusement and for basically parts of his 24-hour-a-day day.
One of the ideas that you sort of introduced there was that he was kind of curating your experience of him. He was sort of setting you up for a mystery, as you say. He's a man who trailed mythologies and apocryphal stories about sort of knavery and misdeeds. Jacob Epstein called him a spiv.
His father-in-law at the time.
How do you engage with those mythologies when you're writing a biography like this?
Well, I didn't set out to write a biography particularly. I was writing a short sort of monograph on his work, and that was in the mid to late 90s. I knew him very well by then because I'd organised exhibitions with him and so on. And as time went on, as we actually, I taped the conversations. He normally absolutely abhors things like tapes and being recorded. As we went on, gradually he liked talking more and more, and we talked more and more, and eventually we said it was going to be a proper book. And he went round saying this is going to be the first funny art book in existence. And as a result, I got him talking and talking and talking. He would ring me up. I never had his phone number. We often changed phone numbers for obvious reasons. And he was always there for the person who initiated a conversation. And the fact that these conversations happened once, twice, three times a day for over years meant that, of course, I had vast amounts of stuff coming from him to me. So what should I do with it? Well, I was recently disengaged from The Observer, so I had a certain amount of time on my hands. And so I wrote down everything he said on the phone, and of course I had the tapes. And so before long, it was clear that I'd got a unique account by him, who never gave accounts of himself and hadn't done in previous years, which I could use, until, of course, he read the first few chapters and he freaked and said he couldn't possibly have all his drivel released to the public. And so we agreed that, as he put it, a novel could appear after he died. And he died in 2011. And after that, I did the writing part, which has gone on and on.
But this idea of sort of his privacy, his desire not to have his life scrutinised publicly, at least before he died, and the way he conducted himself. I know that he would write sort of horrible letters to people who crossed him.
Collector's items.
How conscious do you think he was of maintaining an image of himself? How self-aware was he in that?
He was not narcissistic at all, I don't think. He was very keen on his privacy. And since he was a public figure in some respects, I mean, he was a sort of landmark in a way, that wasn't easy to reconcile. He liked keeping people separate. In his compartments, he had various friends, and indeed, from time to time, girlfriends, women friends. And when we evaded the barriers, and of course, none of us knew each other, this was something which slightly disconcerted him. He liked basically being one-to-one always. He would be great at a dinner table, but on the whole, he, I think, found that one-to-one was the best way of actually communicating, and anything other was sort of tittle-tattle.
Another artist of a kind of similar stature, I think, and certainly culturally of a similar background, who has recently been in, once again, in the public eye, is Leonard Cohen, who was the focus of a film, Marianne and Leonard, that we featured on The Weekly, actually, recently. He seems to have radiated the same sort or a similar sort of charisma in the effect he had on people, the way he attracted people, the kind of life force that he sort of brought into a room. But he seems to have been very conscious to use it as best he could, not to do any harm. You know, one of the things that comes out of the film is that while he carried himself with a certain degree of self-interest, he knew that he could do much worse. And it seems to me that Lucian Freud did do much worse, that a lot of his life was characterised at the very least by a sort of absence of guilt.
Well, you have to orientate things. He had decided at a very early age to be a painter. Mm. Painters need a studio, somewhere to work, and they need, in his case, people to work from and with. And so getting a model, having someone prepared to sit for up to 6-8 hours at a time, and people who otherwise didn't have jobs, obviously, at any time of day or night, this was an enormous demand, and he was constantly on the lookout, on the prowl, really, for people to sit for him, and people appropriate to sit with him, people who were sympathetic in the sense that they weren't going to be irritating, egocentric, or sort of extol themselves above the work that was in progress. And so this set his own compartmentation, really. For a start, you're alone with your sitter. For another thing, you have a daily schedule. And if you don't get the work done, you can't. You have to rely on your sitter. Therefore, there's got to be a close common interest. And stemming from that are things like the love life and so on, which, of course, crop up. And parts of his, during his life, were a great distraction, as were the horses, as were other things like travel and so on. But basically, the core of his life was always the painting, and the painting was, particularly as each painting developed, the painting was the complete focus of everything. Naturally, sitters got upset or they felt discarded when he'd finished with them by doing the work. They got a kind of immortal image, and in exchange they knew they were temporary attachments. And so life was both complicated with lots of people and also very simple. It was one-to-one.
I wondered how, for you, your background as an art critic set you up to write this book.
It really had very, very little effect, except that, of course, I was used to writing and I knew the art world pretty well because by scrambling around in it for so many years. But I think rather more important is the fact that I also paint, and that unlike many art critics who are pundits, I was a practitioner pundit, and that makes a difference. And that meant that my close friends in the art world, who I could only be close friends with really after I stopped being an art critic, were all similarly dedicated to as Lucian was, and very, very strong on loyalties to each other and to seeing with approval, wonder, and a little bit of jealousy, seeing the great things that somebody else in that group was doing. So it was a very potent kind of mix.
Did you show Lucian Freud your paintings?
I didn't show him formally, but when I had shows, he'd come and he'd be kind sometimes, and he'd say, "Well, you can walk about in that landscape and things like that." I never for a moment put myself up as another painter of his equal. On the other hand, every painting is one's painting, and it involves all one's senses at the time.
He did have these artist friends. He was friends with Francis Bacon, who he fell out with. He was great friends with Frank Auerbach as well, who is still making amazing paintings.
He's making amazing paintings for me, though, because you know I sit for him every week and have done for 17 years.
Really?
Yes. Frank and Lucian were great friends. And as you say, Lucian was great friends with Francis Bacon until Lucian started being successful and Francis Bacon started repeating himself in rather bland terms, and there was a natural falling out over that.
But so my question is, how much beyond friendship, how much professional support he offered and he sought? You know, was it a balanced friendship? Was his friendship with Frank Auerbach, was it one, would they look at one another's paintings, or was he looking for feedback but not necessarily up for offering it?
He wanted pretty well every painting he did. There were, well, certainly Frank, and there was me, and there were one or two other people from time to time who would be summoned to breakfast, separately, of course, and we'd take a look at what he was doing. And he didn't want advice or anything like that, really, but he did want one to grunt and point at a bit of the painting. And he would then stare at it as though he's going to sort of scorch it, and you'd have done one's job. And, of course, it was always interesting seeing how things were working and how things were not working. And lots of his paintings didn't work, and he put his boot through them. So the working practice, this was his way of sort of opening it up, but not opening it up to anything wider.
I have a question for you, a sort of professional question, if you will. Not necessarily that appropriate to the paintings of Lucian Freud, but I went to the Valaton exhibition at the RA the other day, and while I was walking around with my friend, who's a poet, I had a discussion about the paintings. Valaton's paintings obviously have a lot more narrative than Freud's studies, figurative studies. But I wondered, for you, what's a painting analogous to? Is it a novel? Is it a short story? Is it a poem? Is that even a useful kind of way of looking at things?
Well, the wonderful thing about a painting is it doesn't need translation. And so it's global, universal, immediately. On the other hand, of course, it's a one-off, and unless it's reproduced endlessly, which is not necessarily a good thing, it becomes rather set apart. So it's different from books in that respect. I think painting is a huge field. Some of it's you're meant to go, wow. Some of it you're meant to gaze at in wonderment and a kind of religious awe and respect. Some you laugh at and some you laugh with. And it's just one of the absolutely basic forms of human expression. I suppose being close to paintings being done all the time means that one sees them in a constant state of a sort of development and flux and possibility and then perhaps disappointment. And that just makes the game all the more, well, perhaps it's like jockeying after all, you know, who's riding what and how well they're riding and what's the form and what's the product. And it takes an enormous amount of devotion to be someone like Lucian and spend one's life doing all sorts of harum-scarum things, but really focusing always on the work in hand.
That was William Fever, The Lives of Lucian Freud, Youth, 1922 to 1968, is out now. It's been wonderfully well reviewed. It's a big one, but as it would be if it was about all the sex and shenanigans, let alone the painting of Lucian Freud. The second part of that book is set to follow this time next year. You should have just about time to finish it by then. You are listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. That is it for edition 535 of the Monocle Weekly.
I produced today's show. Our studio managers were Nora Ho and Max Bauer.
The Monocle Weekly will be back, same time, same place, next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Augustin Macellari.